Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hey everyone, Kevin Cruz here. Welcome to the LeadX Leadership Show. And once again, we are doing something different today. We're going to do, I'll just call this Two Blokes Chat About Leadership, because I have a conversation with Dov Barron, who is an author, leadership expert, executive coach, runs Full Monty Leadership, and he's been on the show before. And we were going to do an episode where he was going to interview me about my new book for his podcast, but he and I always hit it off. He's a crazy guy. He's a high energy guy, smart guy. And I just said, hey, let's just have a conversation because I know it's going to be valuable to both of our audiences. And we'll just run the exact same conversation on both of our podcasts. And so that's what we did. But big warning, listen up, big warning. We curse. There's going to be cursing in this episode. Now, usually I try to not curse. I think we've only had two episodes out of 300 where there was cursing, because every time we have cursing, then I get email from people telling me how awful it is and everything. So if you do not like cursing, if you can't kind of get over those words to hear the hopefully some valuable ideas, don't listen to this show. Don't send me bad emails. I try to keep it under control. But this is an episode where, again, it was just like us having a real conversation about our lives and our careers, and we happen to curse, and that's just the way it is. And I'll promise you, we've got a whole bunch of episodes coming up where there won't be any swear words, but you've been warned. So I hope you settle in and listen to this conversation with the great Dov Barron. All right, I'm recording.
Good. And I'm recording. So I've never done one like this before. So we're kind of just screwing with it and see how it goes.
Yeah, that's what I thought would be fun.
Yeah. So I just want to, so let's do it and be really transparent about it and just say, we've never done this before. This is a two-man podcast.
That's right.
I'm interviewing you. You're interviewing me. And so the traditional intros, I'm not going to be doing.
Right.
And this is a chance for you to eavesdrop in as I get to whisper in the ear of the great Kevin.
I'll do some kind of official intro later. But what everyone needs to know, it's two blokes having a nice chat, and they'll remember the great Dov Barron. And you're coming at a perfect time. I'm not making this up, because I am probably in like the hardest place I've been in 20 years. And you are Mr. Obviously Full Monty. We've had very authentic, very vulnerable conversations in the past. Obviously we do very similar work. And I just thought like I could use a shot, a vitamin B12 shot of Dov today. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I always love having our conversations, and you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to somebody who gets leadership at a level that most people don't. You know, I think that leadership is so often this hard-edged thing that people don't understand the real depth of. And you and I, we get into places that other people don't go with leadership.
Right.
And I love that we both embrace the vulnerability, the power of vulnerability in leadership, and how important that is. I just was speaking in Edmonton yesterday. I was there. And it was fascinating to me. I'm in a room full of leaders. I mean, these are senior leaders, individuals shitting themselves at the idea of being vulnerable.
Yeah, it's
and
crazy.
All I did was pull three or four millennials aside. Let's all remember, millennials are 39 years old already. Like, they're not kids. And said, what do you think about this? And they're like, oh my God, this is so what we need.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's fascinating.
Well, and I forget that everybody doesn't already believe this or do it. I mean, that's what I get shocked when I run into these things. Or you hear sometimes, of course, on LinkedIn or something about my horrible boss who did this or something. Like, who does that these days? Like, I mean, how old fashioned are these people? But
you know, you just said something that I think is really important for us in the context of what we do. I, you know, one of the things that I've talked about a lot is something called assumptive knowledge. Mm. And that we as experts carry a lot of assumptive knowledge. We share things with people and we jump over the first five steps because we think it's basic.
Right.
Everybody knows that. And I have to constantly remind the people that I work with who are my clients, and I have to remind myself that that's not true. Just because it's basic to me does not mean it's basic to somebody else. So for me, you need to embrace vulnerability if you want to bond people to you. It's about as basic as that. No, that's not basic. That is pretty advanced material for most people. Yeah. And I think that the further we get down that road, the easier it is to have assumptive knowledge and assume that they know that when they probably don't. We need to be more curious and find out and just go, well, what do you know?
Right, right.
Nobody wants to look stupid. And the thing is, if you're talking over somebody's head, they'll go, and then they start to feel bad and they ain't calling you back.
Right, right.
They're like, I'm not talking to that Dove guy anymore. He makes me feel like I'm an idiot. Okay, thank you.
I like this phrase. I hadn't really paused to think about this assumptive knowledge, and certainly it applies in what we're here to talk about, leadership. But this happened to me yesterday in the area of, I'm sure, you know, this happens to you all the time. Like anybody who's written a book, everybody's always like, oh, I want to write a book. How do you write a book? Or if you're an entrepreneur, oh, I want to start my business. How do you start? Like, it's always business, author, how do you be a speaker, all this stuff.
Sure.
So, Chris Ducker, another podcaster and all the rest, sent one of his like Academy members to me, you know, through email to give some advice, which I was happy to do. And I said, okay, you know, how can I help you? And the guy says, well, I know you write for Forbes. He says, I'd like to, you know, write for some of the bigger online publications. And, I've reached out to them a couple times and, you know, they've rejected me. I'm just looking for advice. Now, I'm thinking, first of all, it's a really bad time for me right now, very busy time. But I take like a deep breath. I'm like, okay, this guy's, you know, he's a writer, he's a consultant and all this stuff. And he's tried, like, what am I supposed to tell him? Like, I don't know. Like, what am I supposed to tell him? So I think, okay, well, something I've learned over the years is sometimes it's not about knowledge, but it's also about like hope or inspiration or something. So I'm like, all right, well, let me just reach back out. And I said, listen, in a month, I can spend more time with you. But like right now, the short version is, you know, you gotta go to these top editors for the area that, you know, you're interested in and show them that like your following, your expertise matches their audience. Show them three articles that you've written that could have been written for them. Like the content is good and it's for exactly it. And then I said, the key is that they want to see that you can bring some traffic. You've got some mojo. So pick your articles that have like 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 readers, and they'll see like, oh, you can bring some, your social media tribe can come over to our platform. So in my mind, I failed this. I'm like, what did I just tell this guy? I'm like, call the editor, tell them what you write about, show them samples, and they're going to know that you're popular. Like, wow, I wish I had something with this guy. I got nothing. He came back. He was so effusive. He was like, oh my gosh, I never thought to tell them about the traffic I could bring. I didn't think they would have any interest in that traffic. And I'm thinking, to me, my assumptive knowledge is like, who doesn't realize that the Forbes editors, like every other editor, they want to know how many eyeballs you can bring them. You want to sell your book this day to the New York publishers? They'll entertain you as you talk about your title and your fan studies. They want to know, how big's your platform? How many books are you going to sell for them? But I thought everybody knows that already. So I'm thinking like, oh, I just can't help this guy. And I didn't realize like what I thought was so basic, I was like ashamed to share with him. He still viewed it as very helpful. And I was like, all right, I got to remember, not everybody's been on my journey for 30 years, you know?
That's the thing, right? That's the thing with assumptive knowledge. And this is one of the ways that I think that we devalue ourselves, because if you had to put a dollar on that,
right?
What was the dollar? What was it worth to him to get that knowledge? I don't know. Like, you know, if you asked him, he might say, "Oh, that's a $10,000 piece of information."
Yeah.
But for you, it was a 5-cent piece of information.
Right. Right.
And right. This is how we devalue ourselves all the time. You should know this. I had a meeting this morning with somebody who's doing some pretty amazing things out of New York, you know, and I had met her 10 years ago. We're having this great conversation. And she goes, well, I'm just looking to grow my business with, and now she has been at the top of her game for years. And we start talking about something, and she goes, what do you think? How can I grow this? And I go, well, the first thing you need to do is, this is not tiered. And she goes, what do you mean? I said, what are the tiers of offering this? She goes, I don't know what you mean. I go, well, you know, this is, you're talking to me about the entry level tier. She goes, yeah. And I said, well, what would be the next tier? She goes, oh my God, I've never thought about this. And I'm like, isn't it basic? But, you know, but I have to remind myself, right, not everybody's been on my journey. You know, you and I have been doing this for more than 30 years. The stuff that is so basic for us, but for her, it was like, she's like,
yeah,
oh my God, this meeting. She goes, she's from New York. She came in for a conference. She goes, I didn't really want to come, but I came. She goes, but the reason I came was because I wanted to hang out with you a little bit. She goes, and we had 2 hours of coffee. And she's like, this was worth the trip.
It's great. Isn't that great?
But that's the same thing, right? I'm like, yeah, you know, and my wife is sometimes around and she can hear these and she says, do you know how much you gave that person? I'm like, yeah, I just helped them out a bit. She's like, oh no. And this is the thing with us, even as leaders, because assumptive knowledge works in two ways. It works on when we're trying to help. So, you know, you probably already know this, so, but I'll tell you anyway. But it works the other way, and this is where we often fail as leaders, is that we assume they know while they're doing the job. And here's the thing that everybody needs to get. Nobody wants to look stupid.
Right.
So people are really bad at asking questions, and this idea of open door policy is absolute bullshit because there's a force field there. Nobody's coming forward saying, you know, I don't know. Right? They're not doing that.
Right.
So you can't assume. So you have to ask, and it's one of the things when we teach people to be speakers, I'll always say, take the jargon out. And they'll go, okay. And they sit and they come back and they go, that's jargon. And they go, no, everybody knows that. No, that's jargon.
Right.
You just used a word, consciousness. What does that mean? Well, everybody knows that. No, they don't.
Yeah.
You just used the word traffic. Nobody realized that. When I first heard a platform was the year 2000, I was at the BEA, Book Expo America, and I was meeting with all these editors, and they said, what's your platform? And I said, I haven't worn platform since the 70s. I didn't know. Right?
Right. The word that we think is basic, if you step back, you're like, why do they call it that? Like,
exactly, right?
Right, right.
It's jargon. It's code. And people don't want to seem foolish and go, you know, I'm at capacity. That was a word that I didn't even know 10 years ago.
Right, right.
And somebody said to me, I'm at capacity. I'm like, I won't look stupid. But I want to give everybody a little tip here. If you don't want to look stupid and you don't know, so here's how you actually ask the question and make yourself look smart. You ready?
Right. Yeah, I'm ready.
Makes your ego feel good. And it goes like this. Instead of when somebody says, I'm at capacity, that's just the example, right? Or whatever it is they say, and you're like, the hell does that mean? Your response is, instead of saying, I don't know what that means, is to say, in what way?
Oh.
So somebody says, I'm at capacity, in what way? They will then describe what capacity means in that context.
I love that.
Right? And that way you don't look like a dumbass.
Right.
You look smart and you learn something.
Yeah, that's great.
What's your platform? Well, in what way? In what context? Well, you know, how many followers do you have on social media? How many people can you bring to us? Oh, okay. Now we know what platform is. It's a great way around it. It allows you to still look smart and learn something.
Now, Dob, before we keep having fun, I want to straighten.
Oh, damn! Come on.
So officially, so my leadership podcast is the LeadX Leadership Show. Yours is now Leadership and Loyalty. But is this a rebrand?
Yeah, it's a rebrand, and it'll probably get rebranded again.
Yeah.
So
same feed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Link, same feed. It's Dov Barron's Leadership and Loyalty podcast for Fortune 500 executives, because we are the number one podcast in the world for Fortune 500 listeners.
Yep, perfect.
But it's not traditional leadership. It's really thinking about leadership in different ways. So the guest, the show as we're recording right now, Jesse Eisler, we just interviewed him. But last week it was John Oates of Hall & Oates.
That's
and
great.
We talked about the music business and what is leadership in business. And, you know, like as an example, I talked about, well, in business, we're constantly in this disruptive world. There's no more disruptive world than music. And so we talked about, well, what do you hold on to and what do you let go of? So he said, you know, I'm in the music business, have been for 50 years, and I used to be focused on selling records. Well, if that's your job, you've got no job. Right. So he talked about letting go of that, but what do you hold on to? You hold on to what works, and you're always constantly re-examining. He said, so we still do Rich Girl because everybody wants to hear it, but we don't do it the same way.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, how do you keep people loving what it is you're doing while still giving them the taste of the deliciousness of enjoying what it was, but say, well, here's the new flavor of it. Ooh, right. Now add something rather than, well, you're not going to play that because you're sick of it. No. He says, but we still don't try and sell records. And they're selling sold out concerts across Europe and South America and here in the US. So, you know, it's a wonderful lesson about thinking about leadership in a way that's not traditional.
Yeah. So you don't seem to me like a guy who sort of gets starstruck, but with John Hall, was it sort of like, oh, this is so cool, I'm talking to John Hall. Like, do you have that reaction?
Yeah, I don't get starstruck with anybody. I never have. And I don't know why. Maybe I'm just numb. I'm 60, you know, so I grew up with Hall and Oates and those kinds of things. And it was pretty cool to be able to have an intimate conversation with a guy like that, you know, the way you and I are chatting. Yeah. It was pretty cool. And for me, what's always interesting, you know this, Kev, as well as I do, we meet a lot of famous people, not necessarily famous in the big sense of the Kim Kardashian or even Hall and Oates. But they're famous in a niche, you know.
Right.
And oftentimes that's sad because the person I meet is not the person who is the persona. You know this as well as I do.
Yeah.
And not many people are deeply authentic and are going to show up exactly the same. I know that if I'm in a pub in your city or I'm in a restaurant or in Starbucks and I meet Kev, I'm going to give you a hug. You're going to give me a hug.
Yeah.
And it's going to be exactly like
the exact same conversation, right?
It's the same combo. There's just no headphones and no mic.
Right.
Because that's who we are. But we've also met people who are like, well, here I am. I'm the superstar. You know, and you meet them, and they're dicks. It's the only way to put it, right? They're not pleasant people.
So is John Hall probably the coolest guest you've had? I mean, other than me, of course. But I mean, other than me, John Hall.
John Hall has probably got the most cachet for my age bracket.
Yeah. You know, that's a big one. I that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but he's actually a really wonderful human being, which is what I'm always looking for. Is this a person who actually cares about other human beings?
Yeah.
You know, and so he talked about, you know, going from fame to suddenly not being so famous and how he, you know, burned himself out with alcohol and drugs in the rock and roll way and drifted into, you know, going from LA to Colorado to live in a ski town where nobody knew him. And the only thing people were saying to him was not, you know, can I have your autograph, but are you going up the mountain today? You know, so just being very real and shifting to that. Yeah. So he was a very cool guest and a wonderful guest. I know you've had some superstars. Who's starstruck you?
So, you know, I'm similar to you. There's not that many people, like, you know, we're all people, right? So we don't get that starstruck. However, the one person that really sort of has stood out now in, I don't know what, I think I'm around 300 interviews or something, 300 shows anyway. It was Alan Alda. And
really?
Yeah. So I was a kid, but like, my family had that great habit of we ate dinner together every night on TV trays, watching the TV.
We ate together every night.
But my dad was a huge MASH fan. So, I mean, I just grew up, you know, watching all those MASH episodes and everything. And have admired his career since then, you know, not followed a whole lot. I don't watch a whole lot of TV and or things like that. But the opportunity, you know, it was one of those weird things. Like, I don't get like guests like that. But he had a book or something. His people somehow reached out to me and said, hey, you know, Alan Alda's doing his book tour. You know, can he come on the show? I'm like, well, yeah. And then I thought, and I'm like, hey, I said, I really like to do my interviews in person, if at all possible. I said, are you doing a media tour? What cities? And they said, well, he's based out of New York and I'm Philadelphia. So I'm like, sure, I'll come up and do it. And I will admit that, and same kind of thing you mentioned about John Hall, you know, I saw him, he's working out of like this shared office space, like a WeWork or something. And so I get there and he's walking around the halls of like this WeWork and nobody's bothering him. I'm like, do they realize who the heck that
they
is?
They don't
like,
know who the hell he is.
It's so odd, right? And maybe he's there all the time, so they don't care or they've already gotten his order. Like it was weird to me. And then, and we go in this conference room and same thing, like just gracious, pleasant, awesome, really good guy. And he was all, and it, there was the leadership tie. I mean, his book was all about communication and he focuses on like communicating science and hard science. But I mean, he gave just great advice about like looking people in their eye and, you know, not like truly beyond the normal active listening. You know, it's not just parrot back what they say or all those, the things we've heard. I mean, he has a really interesting, you know, approach about it and how he studies like their face and all this. And of course he's coming at this from an improv and an acting thing. You know, improv is always about, you know, yes, and
yes, and
that. And so, you know, it was a great conversation, but I will admit, and it's the only time this has ever happened. I mean, there's a couple times where like, as he's talking about active listening and everything in my mind, the voice is going like, I can't believe Alan Alda is sitting right in front of me. He looks just like Alan Alda. You know, like all this weird, that weird voice goes off in your head as I'm like staring and nodding. I'm like, shut up. Stop saying that. You know,
that is so funny.
It's fun, right? It was just fun. Yeah.
There's so many great, you know, one of the things that I found, you can tell me if you've found the same. One of the things that I have found with is that there are two classes of famous, and there are famous people who, you know, who are famous and are leveraging on that. And there are people who are famous and they're still so human and not, you know, they don't buy into it at all. And I have been so fortunate in the ones that, you know, I've often said that the most successful people I know, the genuinely top tier people who are successful and famous, are, in my experience, the most kind and the most generous people. They're not at all what we think. The ones who think they're famous or maybe are social media famous, that's a different story oftentimes. But these people are just wonderful. I mean, like, you know, oh, sure, what can I do for you? How can I help you? How, you know, just been awesome. And and it's quite the telltale to meet somebody who perceives themselves as famous versus the person who is, you know, Alan Alda level famous.
Right.
But again, that other piece is, like you said, that there is also generationally famous.
Yes.
So, you know, Alan Alda's wandering around and nobody even notices him.
Right. It was strange. It was strange. So, Dov, catch me up on, so we're recording this, we're still in March of 2019.
Yeah.
What's going on in your world, you know, work-wise or personally? You know, what are you looking forward to this year?
This has been a big, some big things. So we got a lot going on. I'm outlining a new book. I you know, I'm like you, I'm a bit of a content machine. Yeah. I think you actually are a bigger content machine in the books department than I am. I'm a bigger content machine in the videos department.
Yeah.
We both have our shows and all those kinds of things. So still doing that. We're now designing a, video course, online course
that
people can do, which will be called All at Once. And it's about how to find your purpose and shift your life all at once by coming to that focus. It's based on the work that we do with companies and organizations and with executive leaders and making it a little bit more accessible for the general public as well.
Love that title and concept. Oh, that's hot. That's hot.
Thank you. Yeah. So we're pretty excited about that. And full credit goes to somebody you know for that title, somebody you and I had a conversation with, a conversation about Mark Levy, my friend Mark Levy.
He's the one who came up with that. Jeez, I should have guessed.
You should have guessed, because Mark is the genius. And any if you don't know who Mark Levy is as you're listening to this, he wrote the book called Accidental Genius. He is a phenomenal human being. He's a very good friend of mine. We meet once a week, and half the time we get nothing done. We're just laughing our asses off and making fun of each other. But so he helped me with that. So that's the course that's coming out. There's an outline for a new book that goes along with that. I've released 3 or 4 ebooks in the last 8 months as well. And the podcast is still growing. We're still doing that. And on top of that, my TV channels are doing great. My TV series, which is called Pursuing Deep Greatness, 11-part series on Roku TV. So that's doing pretty good. We're pretty excited.
Okay, so hold on. This is amazing stuff. So how'd you put the Roku TV series together?
I realized that, you know, Mark and others asked me, because the difficulty for me, as you know, Kev, is I have a very wide and deep set of knowledge. And so we're always drilling in, well, what do people really want to know from you? What do people really want to know from you? And a lot of the people who come to me privately to work with me are very high level achievers who've gotten greatness, success, achievement. But there's a deep greatness within them. There's something within them that feels incomplete, and they don't know what it is. So that was what the thing was about. It was like, how do you get access to that soulful part of yourself? Mm-hmm. And does it mean you've got to go and move to Himalayas and meditate and live on a bowl of rice? Or is there a way to do it? And what we found is in our work is that by tapping into the work that we do, which is pretty intense, people become way more fulfilled. Their life has way more meaning. Their relationships improve vastly. But as a sidebar, their businesses explode. And they're like, I wasn't even focused on business. No, but that's what happens all the time. So that was what we just, okay, so what are the pieces of that that allow you access to that deep greatness? So that's how we developed the series. And that's where it came out, and it got picked up by SmartFam TV and Binge TV as well as being on my own channel on Roku. Yeah. So that's how that came about.
So let me ask this, because we're talking about being content machines, right? And so I do a better job than the average bear out there in terms of like repurposing stuff. So if I'm interviewing an author's got a new book out and I do a podcast interview, okay, that becomes a podcast. I just in the last year, most of the time it becomes a video thing that gets released on YouTube, take the transcript, becomes an article, take little pieces, becomes social media. So like I try to leverage things to be very efficient.
Fabulous.
Having said that, like what I believe and what I see is that the world is shifting really to video, mm-hmm. content. That next generations are clearly on video. I see people like yourself. I see people like Pat Flynn and all these like really moving heavy into video. And that's not natural for me. Like, so if I worked in an office and had a, you know, social media manager, like a Gary Vaynerchuk filming me, okay, that's easy. I just live my life and it's done. Sure. But I feel like I'm so busy doing other things, running software company mainly, and I'm such an introvert, like to pause and be like, oh, wait a minute, let me now talk to my live Instagram audience about whatever and give them, like, it's uncomfortable to me. And so for yourself, I don't think it's uncomfortable for you, but are you just like, hey, I'm a natural on video. It's not hard and it's part of the business. And are you seeing better engagement with video than audio, text, et cetera?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. Everything is moving towards video. I mean, LinkedIn is now, you know, I used to post my videos from YouTube on there. They don't want that anymore. They want native video, raw video posted directly to them. And that's going to get you more engagement, you know, and I'm getting videos with 3,000 to 5,000 views. You know, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I'm not getting that on Facebook anymore. I used to. So, you know.
What about YouTube?
YouTube depends on what it is, and sometimes it takes a while. So, and if I do some ad spend on it, this is the other thing. When people talk about organic, and here's what I've learned. I was just at Traffic and Conversion recently.
Oh, yeah.
Here's what I've learned is organic is full of it, right? It doesn't exist. You have to do ad spend. You've got to make people aware because, you know, you're screaming inside a massive crowd. Right. And you've got to pop up above that. And without ad spend and PR and all those other machines that you prove, you know, we used to think, oh, we don't need that anymore because we're social media. No, you need it now. You need it more. Those days are gone. You need it more.
And a little ad spend will like spike the signals like, oh, people like exactly. it or whatever. And then it might grow from there. But you still had to kind of prime the pump and get it going.
Yeah. So, you know, there are some things that I'll spend $10 a week on. So right. in fairness, but, you know, let me just be clear with everybody. I met people at Traffic and Conversion who were spending $200,000 a month.
Incredible.
A month.
You better have right? a pretty good funnel and product back end on something like that.
Right. So, and by the way, the guy is highly profitable. So if, you know, that 200 grand a year I don't spend on my advertising. Right. I wish I could afford that.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. They're spending a month. Why? Because it works for them. You know, they've built it to understand that. What we know is that, you know, video has worked better for us. And if you're watching this and you're in this space, when Facebook did Facebook Live and it started, they wanted you to be on a long time so they could let people know. And I was on there. I was one of the early ones. I would go on for 45 or an hour and I would do a long dissertation. Now my videos on Facebook tend to be about 4.5 minutes because that's the ideal length where people will engage. Not always live, but right. certainly afterwards that gets us up into the 5,000s and 7,000s. So yeah, it's good. But the thing about it, Kev, you know, this idea about you being an introvert, well, people think I'm an extrovert. I'm not.
Hmm.
That's a push.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I have social anxiety. You go into a room and think, oh, you know, I got to get myself through that. Can I do it? Yes. But that's a training. But here's the thing. For me, I find that my best videos are conversations. And that's not easy for me to do with one of these things.
Right.
You know, like, how are you doing right. on Facebook? You know, I know people do that and I'm like, wow. And my people who see me do it think it is natural, but it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
So the ideal thing to do, again, as you said, having somebody follow you, I've got a client of mine here. He actually has a full-time video guy and he's doing the Gary Vee thing and he catches great things. But one of the things is this, is when you've just done something with a that is conversational. You right. solved a problem conversationally, not as in on a data on a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
You've solved the problem conversationally to come back and say on the video, hey, you know, I was just talking to a client and here's the challenge. And I'm thinking, I wonder how many other people really struggle with this, you know, and I had a conversation with Dov Baron recently about assumptive knowledge. And I realized that this is something I assumed people understood, but actually maybe they don't. And so I want to give you this little tip, right? And that short spin stuff, and it's raw. It's not fancy in any way, shape,
no
or form.
No setup, no planning. You just kind of do it in the moment.
Right. And so I was showing this to one of my clients, and she said, oh, wow, that's interesting. And I said, why? I said, because I look like shit. She goes, well, I wasn't going to say that. I said, because the answer was I had gotten out of bed. I said, and I had this idea. I went upstairs. I worked on the idea. I hadn't showered.
My
hair was like loony. And I just went, hey, if you're doing this, I was just writing about this. I had this great idea. It woke me up. And I filmed that video. I was in a scruffy t-shirt.
Right.
My hair was like a crazy man. Under my eyes. You know, I wasn't looking all polished. And
right.
But you know what? That got a massive amount of response.
That's great.
So I think that part of it is the illusion we have that we've got to be TV ready.
Right, right.
And I think there are pieces that we do that have to be TV ready. But the general, the idea we have to get is I'm having a conversation with somebody, a brief conversation with somebody, and they don't want polished.
Right.
In fact, they would walk away from polished.
Yeah, yeah.
But they will engage with a little bit raw.
So now this is really tactical, but like, so when you said like, hey, the LinkedIn videos are, if they're native, are, you know, they might get 5,000 views. I would think that makes sense to me because a lot of what you do is speaking to, you know, business professionals, you know, all that. So that seems LinkedIn's a good place. Michael Hyatt has a new book out, productivity book. I talked to him last week about it. He said he's spending $1 million a year on ads and his number one platform is Instagram. And I'm like, Instagram? I said, I know that's where the cool kids are. I know it's not, no, the growth isn't in Facebook, but I'm like, I think it'd be LinkedIn or YouTube or something. And he said, we get the most engagement on Instagram. So what's your experience? Like if a, you know, a business consultant, speaker, author person wanted to get started, like, should they start on LinkedIn and build that up? Or should they go right to an Instagram and start building it out on Instagram?
The context is that, you know, I always say, I think you should go where your audience is. So, you know, Gary Vee started out with YouTube. He moved off YouTube onto Facebook. He moved off Facebook, you know, to Snapchat. He moved off Snapchat onto Instagram. So the answer is you've got to go where they're going. And so what we know is that the fastest growing demographic on Facebook is 55 plus.
Mm.
Right? So if I'm going for a 55 plus audience, the wonderful thing about Facebook and Instagram is the advertising there is so niche.
Yeah.
That you can say CEO, 55 years old in the New York area. Fantastic. Okay. Yeah. So that advertising, that's why he's getting such great response, because it's pinpointed.
I see.
Instagram is the attention deficit disorder platform, right? I mean, you know, the video that is on there is 30 seconds.
Right.
Boom, you're done. Right. You can do live on there now, which is better.
Yeah.
And you can do IGTV, Instagram TV. You can do larger, but you've got to do it this way and not that way. And you know, so all right, there's all that challenge too. So I think you just, you know, you have to find out where they are. And the wonderful thing about their advertising platforms is they let you go to that. I personally have been growing my LinkedIn in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't really done that before.
Right.
I'm on Facebook. I have a massive following on Facebook, but it's not really, doesn't put money in my pocket.
Yeah.
So that's what you got to look at. Where does it put money in your pocket? So if you're selling books, maybe right, Facebook is great.
Right.
But if you want to get consulting gigs, maybe you want to go over to LinkedIn and Instagram with a target. Absolutely. Right. But don't you have a new book coming up?
Yeah. Thanks for that setup. Great Leaders Have No Rules. So it comes
That's a fatty.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't want to whine for too long. So the journey of this book is crazy. I wrote it 2 years ago. And, you know, I've done both traditionally published books and indie published books. The last traditional published was 10 years ago. And I thought, well, let me try it again. Like, let me see what kind of offer I'd get. Let me see if I'd get a better publisher than I had before. Let's see if it's worth it. So at the same time that I had finished the book and was, which usually you find your publisher before you write it. I didn't even tell them I had written it because I know they don't like that. So I had already written it because I didn't want the deadline or anything. And so then I go to do that. And at the same time, just over 2 years ago, I started up in stealth mode LeadX, which I don't even know if you know this, Dob, but like I've created with IBM Watson, the first AI powered executive coach robot. So
I read this morning that you were using Watson, because I know what Watson is. And let's backtrack a little bit and get rid of assumptive knowledge for the list. So please let's tell them first of all what Watson is, because that is like mind blowing. I did a presentation yesterday, which is how to thrive as a leader in the AI era.
Right.
So it's perfectly aligned. Tell
yeah,
us what,
so,
what Watson is.
Yeah. So IBM Watson is IBM's branded version of artificial intelligence. And that's the platform that beat the human Jeopardy champion and beat a bunch of chess champions. There's been other platforms that have gone on to beat like Go champions and things. But Watson is the kind of the brand most people know and think of when they think of like a thinking computer. And that's where, you know, artificial intelligence, they talk about it as being, you know, cognitive computing, because rather than sort of just implementing the traditional lines of code that a computer would, it starts to process things in a different way and gets smarter and smarter as you interact with it. So we can come back to that later. But anyway, I knew I was starting up this company again, and startups being what they are, there wouldn't be a lot of time to write or publish a book. So I had already written it, got a publisher called Rodale. And the first thing that happens is they give me the contract, and then I meet with the editor. And of course he says, well, we love your book except for, and you need to write about this. You need to write about that. And I want you to include sports stuff, and I want you to do this. And it needs to appeal to parents and moms and health and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, all right, fine. So now it's got like a massive rewrite that I hadn't planned on. Okay. I rewrite it. I submit it. And it's like crickets, like nothing's happened. I'm like, what is going on? Turns out Rodale got acquired by Crown Penguin, which is a bigger, better business publisher. But I get this brand new editor calls me out of the blue and says, hey, I'm your new editor. You know, we just got acquired. I got assigned you. Like, what's going on? She didn't have the revised manuscript. She didn't even have the proposal. She didn't have the notes. I'm like, oh, this is great. So she's like, we've got a new pub date for you. And it was a year later than the original pub date. So the first lesson, as you know, if you're an indie publisher, you could write a book this month and publish it the next month. I mean, it's
absolutely
out. So I had already written it for a year. Then it was going to be a year. Then she added a year, which pushed the pub date to now. And while I'm like, we came out of stealth mode on the startup in November, I'm full time selling and trying to manage cash flow and blah, blah, blah. And then, the traditional publisher thing continues to, it's not just like most authors will say, like, they'll complain about the normal stuff. Well, they didn't really do any marketing. You know, they didn't really do any help. Well, all that's true, but it's worse. They hurt marketing. They hurt chances of success. You know, they picked the worst title with their gut instead of the best title that I had data on. They delay everything. Like, they're basically blockers. They're author blockers. And so this whole thing has been painful. And then I can't blame them for this. So Dov, and then I'll get off this whiny white guy thing, right? Doesn't play well. So finally, you know, it's like all this stuff. I'm busier than anything. This is literally the biggest book launch in a decade that I've had. Like, sure, lots of money on it, lots of time and everything. It's going to be in the airport bookstores. I'm on this media tour, all this stuff. And so 10 days ago, right as I now am behind schedule, I'm doing 4 to 6 interviews a day, and I need to ship out 200 review copies of the book to people like yourself, who I'm getting ready to talk to book reviewers. It's like 250 books need to get mailed out. My assistant resigns with no notice. One line text. Can you believe this? So already I was like I've been on 4 hours sleep for like a month, right? 7 days a week. Like, I'm Mr. like productivity and balance, and like, oh no, not in the last month. And then she like text message resigns, and I'm like, oh.
Text message resigns.
Text message. You know how you hear like people break up with their lovers like in a text message? She broke up with me in a text message.
Oh my God.
So all of a sudden,
this is a comedy of errors.
It's a comedy of errors. So it was already bad. And then for the last week, it's like, okay, I've got 200 books stacked up in my kitchen that need to get signed, shipped. I've been at the post office myself. I have another assistant. She's got a bad family situation, so she's out of town. I would put my kids to work, but they're off at college. If it was the summer, it wouldn't be a problem. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I am so stressed. So whatever, the launch, I'm wasting so much time and money because of what just happened. But anyway, yes, new book coming out. Great Leaders Have No Rules. It will do fine. It will be fine. And these are good quality problems to have, you know, but it's rough.
Can we go there for a minute? Is it okay?
Sure, please. Yeah.
I want to go there for a minute, and I'll tell you why.
All right.
Because, you know, white guy problems, first world problems, we got all that. Okay, true. But at the same time, they're still real.
They're real to me, yeah.
We can downplay them. We can talk about, you know, nobody's going to die. And that's all true. And let's not take that away. Of course, that's all true. But at the same time, these are real problems. And I call them joy stealers. That's what I call them. right? I did a delivery, a presentation yesterday. It was the first time I delivered that presentation. I was awesome. Mm. Audience, not so much, right. But I was awesome. Yeah. It took me about 20 minutes to get them involved, and then they went along. But, you know, at the end of it, I went, first time delivering this, I rocked it. I took very cold people who did not want to be in that room and turned them around, and I was joyous. I didn't let anybody in the room steal my joy.
Yes.
But I stole my own. How? I left my laptop at the airport. With my presentation, brand new laptop, all that stuff. I get on the plane. I'm feeling joyous about what I've just done. Go in my bag, and it's not there. And I know exactly where I've left it. And my joy gets sucked away.
Right.
And it takes commitment to bring the joy back. And I think that this is what, when you talk about first world or white guy problems, is how do you, I want to know from you, what do you do to try and bring it back? Because how many authors are out there going, oh my God, I'm just trying to get a book deal.
Yeah,
right. You know, they would bang down your door to give you a book deal.
Right.
How many authors out there wish they had 200 people to send review copies to? Who wish they could get on the shows that, people are begging you to come on. How do you balance that piece for yourself with the context of the joy stealing, which is stress, is cortisol.
Yeah.
And the balance on the other side, which is, this is pretty awesome. How do you do it?
Well, I mean, you help by reframing and looking at the positive. And when I'm at my best, like I'm usually, my emotional state isn't usually exuberance or joy. Like my natural state, if anything, I think is on the low side. Having said that, my level, at least in the last 10 years, of like contentness and peace and satisfaction is very high. And what's helped that is like a consistency with like my morning ritual. So for myself, it's reflecting and reciting like my personal mission and purpose. Then I immediately do a gratitude practice. So I every morning I try to think about and really not just list three things that I'm grateful for, but like try to make it different and to feel, you know, that
feel gratitude. It, yes.
And now this can, for a lot of people, will sound dark. Like, you know, there's some things that you could pick to be in your gratitude practice. Like, I'm grateful that I've got such great cup of coffee this morning. I'm grateful because I can see the beautiful trees and it's a 70 degree day. Spring is here. Like positive things. I do, for whatever reason, like the Stoic philosophers would talk about, I call it like doomifying, like focusing on how bad things can be. And again, like, I don't want to bring the listeners down, but like, again, we've lived life, Dov, and you and I have talked even off the air, like we've lost friends, and we have friends who are survivors of cancer, and we have adult friends who have children with severe challenges that they're, you know, so often in my quote unquote gratitude practice, like if I'm really feeling sorry for myself, having a pity party, I'll do the Stoic thing and be like, okay, you know what I'm grateful for? I'm grateful that I've got my limbs. I still have two legs and two arms because, you know, just yesterday I passed someone on the sidewalk who doesn't. I'm grateful that I can see. I'm grateful that I've had three kids and they're all still freaking alive. I mean, I'm grateful I'm not in a refugee camp in Syria or something, right? I mean, there is so much effing awfulness out there that, again, to just sort of say, you know what, like, I'm the luckiest, and I do believe I'm the luckiest motherfucker on the planet, you know? Sure. And, but it takes that mindfulness to pause and reflect on that. And for me, like until this month, I had a pretty good streak going. And what happens, you know, we're all human, we're all animals. Like in the busiest, you know, quote unquote, worst moments, then you wake up out of bed and it's like, okay, I've got 100 books to sign and ship out today. Giddy up. And you jump past the gratitude practice. You jump back. Like if I'm really stressed out in the middle of the day, I'll go to box breathing, you know, a four count, inhale for four, hold for four, exhale for four, hold for four, and then repeat. So I can do those things to bring myself back on that. And I've been trying the last few days. But the other thing I will add that just triggered, you know, one of my core beliefs is that the number one variable to success in almost anything is environment. And part of environment for your mind is your body. You know, it's the your body's the environment of your mind. And so the other thing is when I get dark, when I start to slip, it's because I haven't been sleeping 7-8 hours a night. It means I'm not drinking enough water through the day. It means I'm eating high carb comfort foods for pain relief rather than vegetables and a more balanced, slow or low carb diet that's going to make me feel more energized and even. And so I think that's the thing. And this is awesome that you asked me this question because it's helping to remind myself in my darkest times what I need to get back to. Because we all, in our hardest times, it's easy to make the pain go away with, you know, the second, third or fourth bourbon or the third, fourth or fifth slice of pizza or whatever our vice is, right? Or all of those. And you really need to kind of break your pattern and say, okay, wait a minute. I am so grateful that I've got a book deal and I am proud of the book, best book I've ever written. If it helps one person, then it is an awesome thing that has happened. And it's a bummer, all these other things that are going on, they're a bummer. But let me recenter, realize, well, we're on a marathon, not a sprint. This won't be my last book. I hope this is my last year, knock on wood, and kind of go from there, I guess.
I think there's some really great insights there for everybody. You know, because I feel like this idea, like I do a gratitude ritual too, but I feel like that's stuff that's thrown around and people don't get it. And I remember when I was going through my dark times that you and I have talked about before, like realizing that I need to do gratitude and doing it and going, yeah, I might as well be, excuse my language, but pissing in the wind. I mean, this is like, it doesn't have any content for me. Mm. And I was just doing it by rote until I got to what can I feel grateful for? Not That's what can great. I be grateful for, but what can I feel grateful for? And that was the distinction. And because it was like, I got nothing to be grateful for because I'm so pissed, or, you know, I'm smashed to pieces or whatever it is. But what can I feel grateful for? And sometimes it is that first sip of coffee.
Right.
That I, cause I, that's because it is tactile.
Right.
I can go, yeah, I can feel good. Like, Jesus, I pass a guy who's drinking a cold cup of coffee that somebody left on the side because he's homeless and I can have my coffee that I made my way. I can feel that. I can feel my feet on the floor when I got out of bed. And there are people, like you said, who have no limbs who never do that.
That's right.
And that's the key for me is to feel. So my wife and I have a ritual we do every night. You know, it's a whole ritual piece. You know, my wife, I'm going to do it tonight. I was a little tired. Yeah, we're going to do it. You know, and I'm tired too. But the whole thing about it is it has to involve all of our body. So we have to move. We do it. And my wife will sometimes laugh at me because I'm doing all kinds of crazy movements. But the idea of it is that your body moves, and when it moves, it translates to emotion, and emotion will change your brain. And so then the words I'm saying have feeling to them. How can I right now in this very moment more fully, completely, totally, and absolutely own, claim, and embody that this is me in my natural state of joy, gratitude, love, and flow? Now, I'm not feeling that way before I start, but I tell you what, when I start doing that with that emotional language and I start acting it out, I feel different now than I did 4 seconds ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that the motion is the core of emotion, and to get the body doing that is key. And I need to move more because, and this is just general good tips. I mean, we're all become like at the desk, right? You know, doing this thing.
So hot, productive. Man.
Meanwhile, internally, your soul just dies a little bit. Then it
exactly. From the slow death.
Yeah.
Your book is about nonconformist leadership.
Yeah.
I hope we got enough time here because I want to find out some of those. Because to me, that's like, those are the nuggets. Like, because I think that there's so much about leadership that people think it has to be this and it has to be that. And I think that that's absolute horse crap because I'm a contrarian.
You said something early in our conversation that I thought you were purposely kind of leading into the book where you said the open door policy is BS because people don't want to go. So that's my first chapter. My first chapter is called Close Your Open Door Policy. And so again, great minds think alike, right?
Right.
And I mean, that's an example where so many people are told, you know, about the open door policy and the goals are worthy and all the rest. But to your point, first of all, about half the people out there, you know, they don't have whatever it is, the courage, the confidence, whatever, to go through the door. So that the open door policy is a passive way to lead, saying, well, my door's open. It's their fault if they're not coming in and communicating with me. The people who do come in, it can also signal that they don't have the psychological safety to make a decision on their own, to take a chance, to try something. So, you know, I'm not saying close the door completely, but it's like, okay, have more active ways to have communication, whether that's weekly one-on-ones, the anonymous survey. You can still have your office, quote unquote, office hours, so that maybe your open door policy is, you know, 1 hour a day or 1 day a week, whatever it is, because there is that practical part of when everybody's constantly got a minute, you know, we get nothing done. We don't get any deep work done, any focused work done. So, I mean, that was funny that you had brought that up because that's the first chapter. And the only other one I'll just bring up is the chapter that the title refers to, Great Leaders Have No Rules. It was 20 years ago, I had sold my company, you know, into this bigger company. I was going to be vice president, report to the CEO. He gave me that big speech. Oh, we're just partners. I'm not your boss. We'll build this company together. And Dov, I was about there for about 1 month and I get my first like expense check and it was short by about $4. Not a lot of money, but I'm like, I must have filled out the form wrong or something. And so I said to the CFO, like, hey, what's up? Did I do something wrong? He says, oh no. He says, we deducted your Post-it notes. We don't reimburse for Post-it notes. I said, why? He says, it's a wasteful expense. So I bumped into my first rule and all of a sudden not being allowed to buy my $4 Post-it notes, how much did I feel like a partner in the company? How much did I feel like an equal? And the story just illustrates that rules, you know, they might start with the best of intentions. In this case, I guess, cost control, et cetera. But every time we bump into a rule, it takes away the opportunity for us to make a choice, a decision, and it becomes your company, not my company. And so while we're trying to protect against the 1% of knuckleheads that might do something stupid, the 99% are becoming disengaged. Rules crowd out conversation. And a better way, people really fight me on this because I even say, like, I've got teenagers and I say, like, parents shouldn't even have curfews for their kids. That's a rule. Better is have a conversation about it. What are your standards? What are your values? What are the guardrails? And if someone screws up, if someone's a knucklehead, that's called a coaching conversation. That's called an effective feedback moment. And if they keep doing it, it's called get them out of your company.
Exactly.
So look, if there's a law or something, I guess you have to have a rule. But that was really eye-opening for me back in the day. And it kind of sat with me and became the core of like all these things, stupid things that big companies do that we really got to ignore or do the reverse of. Like, let's close our open door policy and work harder at you know, proactive communication.
I loved, I mean, when I saw that, I loved it. It was so appealing to me. Very recently, I did a video and it said why you should throw out all the rules.
Oh, that's great.
Right. And the reason, and I talked about why, and it was like why everybody will always break your rules. First of all, it is human nature. Right. The children learn to break rules. That's how they explore the world. And what rules do is rules are black holes for joy. That's a Dove quote. Mm. Rules are black holes for joy. They suck the joy out of everything we do. They rob us of so much that's so valuable. And what we need instead is boundaries. But people don't understand the distinction between a boundary and a rule, right? So my boundaries have consequences. I'm clear about my boundaries because here's the deal. Rules are about you, what you're not allowed to do. Boundaries are about me.
Yeah.
This is how I live. This is so the boundaries I have with my wife are exactly the certain boundaries I have with my wife that I have with Kevin Cruz,
yeah.
that I have with my clients, that I have with my friends. Those are the same boundaries.
Yeah.
Right. So rules are, so I'll give the best example I've got. The rule is there's no smoking, right? Okay, that's the rule. Mine, my boundary is no smoking. You can smoke up the yin yang. You can smoke out of every orifice you've got. You just can't do it around me because it creates an allergic reaction with me that makes me want to vomit.
Right.
It makes my eyes burn and my skin crawl, and I just dislike it immensely. But I have no problem. You want to shoot heroin? Go for your life.
Right.
None of my business.
Right.
I don't get to control your life. But if you want to come around my house and sit on the couch and shoot up, we're going to have an issue with that.
That's right.
I have boundaries for me, and you, I don't want rules for you. Because what I know is the happiest people on the world in the world do not make rules for other people.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's right. That's right.
So, I done a video on that recently, and it's so aligned with what you're saying. And I think that as leaders, we actually think we have to make rules.
Right.
And we don't get a consensus. We don't have a conversation like you were saying. If we get a consensus, and I'm not talking about leading by consensus. We're like, let's find out what's actually happening for people. Let's get curious and then say, well, what's the boundary that would work here?
Right.
Because this is never going to be okay in our organization. You know, if you want to treat a customer poorly, that's great. You just can't do it here.
Yeah. It's funny. The second part to that story, I went to the CEO to say, like, this is ridiculous. And to his credit, he immediately said, Kevin, he said, okay, that's no longer a rule. People can buy post-it notes and all that. I didn't know it was bumming people out. He says, but let me explain. He says, I don't care about post-it notes. He said, one of our values is profitability. And that's usually not a value of a company, but his was. He said, look, it's not our mission, but it's like the air we breathe. We need to be profitable to go on. So he says, that was our value. And he said, I would walk around and see people with their post-it notes. They'd be doodling on them. They take phone messages. He says, you know what I use for that? And he grabbed some scrap paper off the printer that he had torn, you know, into squares. And he says, that's what I use. And he says, it doesn't cost any money. So he said that the post-it notes was a symbol of frugality, a reminder of our values. Now, here's the thing. He overturned the rule. I stayed there 5 years, longer than my non-compete thing and all that. I never again bought and tried to get reimbursed post-it notes, even though he overturned the rule. Because now he had a conversation with me. I realized it was a conversation about values. It was a conversation about the culture and the symbolism. And look, I wanted to be a partner. I wanted to be a team player. I got it then. I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. I don't want to be the guy doodling on the post-it note when the culture doesn't support that. So it became my choice not to buy post-it notes, you know? And that's the interesting thing. If someone had taken, when there's rules, it's easier to just walk around and enforce rules than to be a leader. Way easier. Oh, you know, you're dressed inappropriately. Here's the rule that says that or whatever it is. It's harder to say, hey, Kevin, it's your first month here. Let's talk about our values and let's talk about what they mean to me, what they might mean to you. Let me talk to you about some history around this stuff. And then you went and bought post-it notes. Let me have a conversation. No problem. We're going to reimburse them. You can buy post-it notes. Just want to let you know, here's what other people might think when they see you scribbling on post-it notes. It's easier to have a black and white rule that you're then like the rule police. It's harder to be a leader and to teach your team and to coach your team around the values. But anyway.
Well, that's the point you just made that I think that everybody misses. Is that boundaries are a statement of here's my values.
Yeah.
The rules are not, there's no conversation.
There's no, right. You don't know where they're coming from. Right?
This is like, you know, the speed limit is 50 miles an hour. Why? See, I think the most important question any leader can learn is why.
Mm.
Like, you know, this is our guideline. Okay, why? Well, because because here's the thing, if we don't buy post-it notes and I'm having a conversation, I go, okay, that's a bullshit rule.
Right.
But if you say to me, let me explain to you why it matters to us.
Right.
We're frugal or we're socially responsible. And, you know, every time you buy post-it notes, you know, trees go down.
Right.
Oh, okay. Now I'm like, I don't want to buy post-it notes.
Right. Exactly.
I care about the planet.
Right.
Or because I understand the profitability of a business.
Right.
That conversation of the why, and you know, and this is the problem with us. We've got so damn busy.
Right.
We've forgotten to have the conversations that answer the why. And so let's put forward, okay, these are the quote rules, shitty word, but these are the rules. And now let's say, okay, here's what I need. We're going to have a town hall, and you get to ask any question that starts with why about that values, those values. Yes. That starts with a why about those rules,
right?
Because maybe we need to change them.
Right.
And people would go, fantastic. Who wouldn't show up for that meeting?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And that's why I love what you're doing in this book, because I think it's time we wake up to the, I mean, because it's the, for me, it's the last elements of command and control just trying to hold on desperately.
Right.
It's done, dude. Get over it.
That's right. But, and this is, you know, maybe we can end on this point. Like I, like you, I, to me, there's not work and life. There's just life. And we lead in all areas of our life. I challenge often at the end of these segments, I say, okay, well, start at home. Like most people who have kids, they have teenagers. There's a curfew in place. In my mind, that's a rule. I know a lot of people, I mean, this sounds like, I don't know, just crass or direct. Like I know tons of guys who say like they are forbidden by their wives to go to like strip clubs, you know, they want to go to some party on Sunday night, but they can't because Sunday is for family. It's like a rule. And what I say is like, listen, you know, do you want your spouse, it could be men or women, right? So do you want your spouse to not go to the strip club with their friends because it's a rule, or because they don't want to, because they value your feelings. They value your relationship. They don't want to bring stress into the thing. You're like, it's a whole different thing to say, look, you can go or not go, but I want to let you know how I'm going to feel about it. When you go, I'm going to be jealous. I'm going to be nervous. I'm going to feel disrespect, whatever it is, right? You know, for each person. Sure. And it's a whole different conversation. And the same thing with your kids and curfews. It's not that I don't care and that my kids come home anytime they want. It's that when they say, Dad, there's an important high school party. How late can we stay out? I don't say it's 11 o'clock or you're in trouble. I say, well, listen, you know, I love you so much. I'm going to be worrying about you until you get home. I can't fall asleep until you get home. And you'll probably remember your brother's got an important basketball game that I got to get him to at 7 in the morning. So I got to get up early too. And I know this party's important to you, but you hear what's going on in my world. What time do you want to get home? And usually they'll say a number that's earlier than I would have said. You know, yeah. They're more conservative on that than I am. And so even for the listeners who are like, well, this is crazy. I'm not going to tell my kids there's no curfew. I would say have the conversation. So even if you hold to the quote unquote rule, then at least have a conversation about it. Hey, kids, why do you think that curfew's in place? What do you think about that time? How do you feel about it? And some of the stories like I hear about, people are like, oh yeah, you know, I was so deathly afraid of my dad. I'd be driving home 100 miles an hour to get home at 11 o'clock. You know, they're putting their lives at risk for some made up ridiculous rule because they'd be in trouble at 11:05, you know? So
exactly.
It's just crazy, but.
Yeah, my eldest son, Michael, you know, he was 16, 17 high school kids are drinking.
Yeah.
I know that. I'm not daft. You know, I was too. Right. So I get it. So I said, hey, Michael, here's the deal. If you're going to go out and drink, that's okay. You can do that. However, I would, because I love you, because I care about you, yeah. I don't want you to ever get in a car with somebody who's been drinking even one drink. Yeah. And I certainly don't want you to ever drive it in that case. And here's the deal. You can call me. I don't care if it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't care if you're blind drunk. You can call me and I'll come pick you up and I won't give you shit.
I've had the same conversation.
I promise you I won't give you shit. We will talk about it tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I won't give you shit even tomorrow. We'll just talk about it. And he's like, okay, guess what? Michael never touched a drink until he was 20. Didn't matter. His drunk friends got on his nerves. They annoyed him.
Right.
You know, because he had complete freedom to do it. I said, Michael, you can do any drug you want. I'm okay with that. I know that your friend's parents are going to say different things, but I'm going to tell you, you can do any drug you want.
Yeah.
What I just want to know is, what drug you're going to do and where you are.
Yeah.
I said, because here's the deal. I've done drugs.
Yeah.
I know the impact of them. And I just want to make sure you're safe. But if you want to do it, that's okay. And even if you want to do it at home, it's okay. you know, I just want you to be safe. That's it.
Yeah.
Guess what? Michael never did any drugs.
Yeah.
His mates were all drunk and hanging out. They were doing lots of different drugs. He never touched them because it is our nature to break rules.
That's right.
And if we set up rules as taboos, the human condition is I need to break the taboo.
That's right. That's
remove
right.
the taboo. People are like, okay. When people go, well, that's ridiculous. That's not leadership. Well, I don't know. Your kid is in the drunk tank.
Right, right.
My kid was home at 11.
Yeah.
What's your deal? I don't know. Maybe you just got lucky. Yeah, that must be what it was.
Yeah, no, and you simplified it. I liked it. It's like it's the conversation. It's really the key. You know, rules crowd out. It's just there's no ability to ask why or exceptions or whatever it is. So,
well, you know, you and I are the age group that was why? Because I said so.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is, and if you're leading from why? Because I said so, you are a dinosaur.
Yeah,
dying out.
I had two older sisters, so they got it worse than me. But like, so I was younger, they'd be, you know, 16 and 10 p.m. curfew from my dad. And I would see he would start to get animated as it's 9:55, 9:50. They'd come in at 10:05 and it was World War III, right? And they're lying. No, my watch says 9:50 and he's mad. And all that. And you could see like, the intent was to have his kids home and safe at a reasonable, but it, sure. The rule turned it into a really negative family situation, right? They're now lying. They're now scared. It's about power and authority, right? They're not following this. He's thinking it is his house and they're challenging that. They're like, this is dad's family, not our family, right? We didn't have a say in this. It was, and it got a whole lot worse after that. So, I mean, I growing up seeing that, you know, like we realize because, you know, we all went and did those things anyway that they were trying to protect us from. There's a better way. Dov, let's do this. We have so much fun. Like in 3 months, we got to do this again, whether we have things to promote or not, just to come up with some good content. And I feel better. I knew I would spending time with you.
Thank you. I'm glad. I loved having a conversation.
Tell my listeners where they can, you know, follow along, find out, get all your good stuff.
Thank you. Appreciate that. You can find out more about me at fullmontyleadership.com. There you'll get access to my blog, which is under icons. And by the way, you can even vote for Kevin as an icon of leadership. Because we actually have icons, a vote on there. So fullmontyleadership.com, you can go to fullmontyleadership.com/consulting or speaking regarding bringing me in. You can find out about my podcast on there. You can find out about the blog. You can find out about my YouTube channel. I'm of course on LinkedIn, Twitter, everywhere, Instagram. You can DOVBARON. And the other thing I say to people think I'm nuts for doing it, but here's the thing. If you want to write to me, my personal email is dov@dovbaron.com, dovbaron.com. Because one of the things I truly deeply believe is podcasts, even in the video format, are not supposed to be passive.
Right.
You are supposed to do something with it. So write to me and tell me and CC Kevin too, and tell us what you got out of this and what you're going to do with it. And by the way, also go and subscribe to Kev's awesome, awesome, awesome podcast. I'm honored to be on it. Go subscribe to it, rate and review it. That matters. It lets us know that this was impactful to you. So please go do that. Like I said, write to me, tell me about it. I'm happy to answer all of your questions. I'm on this planet to serve. Now your turn, Kev. You tell us, tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, your shows, and all the fabulous resources you've got.
Yeah, no, that's great. The book again is Great Leaders Have No Rules, available online, bookstores, everywhere. There's a bunch of pretty good bonuses. I know that's getting to be a cliche with book launches, but if you go to norulesleadership.com, you buy one copy of the book and you'll get my other digital books. You get 90 days free access to this LeadX platform, et cetera. That if you want to talk to IBM Watson AI, have a little coaching conversation, you can get a free trial at leadx.org. And Dov, like you, I've fallen behind, but I try to respond to everybody that emails. So I'm just at kevin@kevincruz.com as my personal email address. And hopefully people are going to be entertained by this crazy format.
Well, that's it. It's the definitely never done a dual podcast like this. This is awesome, mate. And I agree with you. I think we should make this a regular thing once a quarter. Yeah. And we don't need to be promoting anything. We're just like, we can philosophize and save the world.
That's right. That's right. Or at least save each other.
Yeah, potentially, that's a heck of a lot more likely, I think.
Dov, thanks.
Thank you, sir. It was an honor and a pleasure.
Friends, if you like this episode of the LeadX Leadership Podcast, please take a minute, leave a rating on iTunes or Stitcher. Ratings are invaluable for attracting new listeners. And I like to convert those listeners into leaders because, you know, I'm on a mission to spark 100 million leaders in the next 10 years. And if you want to become the boss everyone fights to work for and nobody wants to leave, check out the LeadX platform with Coach Amanda at leadx.org. And if you have 10 or more managers who could use some binge-worthy training, send me an email at info@leadx.org, leadx.org, and we'll talk about getting you set up with a totally free pilot for those managers. See if they like it. If they don't, that's fine. We go away. Part as friends. But if they love it, you've just found yourself a new resource for them. Remember, leadership is influence. You're always leading. How are you going to lead today?